Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian news and commentary podcast from the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hi, everyone.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We are going to point out that the president of the United States is lying his face off about the multi-trillion dollar social spending bill on Capitol Hill in a moment. But first, do you value the privacy of your own data? Well, let me introduce you to Secure, the instant messaging and email platform hosted in a little country we like to call Switzerland. Using military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in Switzerland, Secure protects your data from various intrusive governments and laws. It features 100% homegrown technology and zero affiliation with big tech giants like Amazon, Google, Microsoft. Make your move to Secure by visiting secure.com. That's S-E-K-U-R.com. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. So we're going to answer Bernie Sanders's call to actually explain some of the contents of the huge reconciliation spending bill being negotiated in a cloakroom somewhere in Washington. But first, I wanted to direct our attention to an official tweet put out by the White House last night. The cost of Build Back Better agenda is $0. The president's plan won't add to our national deficit, and no one making under $400,000 per year will see their taxes go up a single penny. It's fully paid for by ensuring big corporations and the very wealthy pay their fair share. End tweet. Everything about that tweet is a lie. The cost is zero. Is not zero. The cost has 13 zeros. The deficit will increase as it does every second that we're not passing trillion-dollar spending bills. The plan includes taxing by more than a single penny anyone who consumes nicotine products, regardless of how much money they make. It is not remotely fully paid for, and I will personally guarantee that long after it passes, Democrats will still be complaining that big corporations and the very wealthy are not paying their fair share. It's bad to have people lying from the White House, regardless of political party. It's bad to use gaslighting only when there's a certain Republican in the White House and not a Democrat. There's no excuse to tolerate this behavior. Stop it. Moving on. Democratic Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders on Friday put out a statement complaining that the press has done an exceptionally poor job covering the reconciliation bill with very limited coverage as to what the provisions of the bill are. So let us hear Build Back Our Own Better coverage or something and discuss some of the individual provisions in this massive, monstrous, gargantuan bill being negotiated on Capitol Hill. Catherine, you've taken a needle through the haystack. What have you found in this bill that is worth discussing and elucidating further per Bernie Sanders?
I thought that I would complain about one of the most popular parts of the bill because that's how I roll, which is the childcare subsidy. So there's three ways in which this bill is giving support to people who have kids. There is a child tax credit, there's a childcare subsidy, and then there's universal preschool. They're differently controversial. The child tax credit in particular, there are Republican versions, there are Democratic versions, where should it be kept? All of that is being fought over. Universal preschool seems pretty popular. That is confusing to me because school isn't that good. We like the school, the public schools that we have are kind of crappy. And so it's weird that it's like that, but two more years.
I mean, it's a this food is terrible and the proportions are too small problem.
Exactly. It is absolutely like the cruise ship buffet of education. And we are not even in the VIP room. So do cruise ships have VIP rooms? That felt right when I said it. And then it felt wrong. Okay.
Yes, they do. So,
but you're wherever, not supposed to admit
wherever
it.
Wherever Jacob Sullum is.
Like, yeah,
is the
wherever
VIP
like
room.
The shrimp cocktail is, like most of us are not in that room. And Universal.
The buffets on cruise ships are pretty good.
Universal preschool is like that. But the most popular part actually is the child care credit. That would do this very weird thing that people seem to think is good, which is that they would make it way more expensive to be a child care provider. So they would create a whole bunch of regulations and paperwork. They would create more standards and more rules for child care providers to follow. They would also put floors on the wages of child care workers, significantly higher than they are now, something like 150% higher. And then they would subsidize it. So they're going to make it more expensive and then they're going to subsidize it. But places that have done this, like Quebec, show that there is no evidence that it actually improves the quality. So we're just going to get the same thing, but make it harder to provide. And then we're going to have taxpayers pay for your dumb kids. And I think humans are the ultimate resource, and I want more people, and I like it when people have babies, including, for instance, Reason's own Elizabeth Nolan Brown this week, but subsidizing childcare ain't the way, and it is certainly not infrastructure or whatever.
My favorite part about that is that the White House has been responding to concerns that inflation is going up recently by pointing to their child care provisions and saying, well, look, we're going to subsidize that and that'll make it cheaper. And that is how we are going to fix the inflation problem. When in fact, what they're going to do is make it much more expensive and less efficient and harder to provide. And that's kind of the whole inflation problem.
I'm beginning to think maybe people don't totally understand what inflation is. Just throwing that out there.
We should do an entire seminar podcast, or maybe Nick can do another one with an economist. The universal pre-K thing is incredible to me, in part because we've been seeing what's happened over the last 2 years with K, you know, like universal K, which happens right in schools, which is to say, people are leaving it in droves. The numbers are absolutely staggering. How like all the 3 million people or so left the K through 12 public system, but a huge percentage of that was just kindergartners over the last couple of years during the coronavirus. People are looking at this free thing offered by the government, saying, "No, I don't like the way that you do this.
Yeah. It's fine. I'm full."
So let's
kindergarten though is also a particularly annoying thing. I know my kids were in daycare, and then when they went to kindergarten, it was just like a logistical nightmare, because daycare started at like 7 or 8 and went until 5 or 6. Kindergarten, it starts at 9 or 9:30 and then it ends at 12:30, or, you know, and Wednesdays are half days, blah, blah, blah. You know, I think universal daycare is much more popular.
When back in the 90s or the aughts, when Rob Reiner, Meathead, went to sponsor a universal pre-K initiative in California, I believe it was. And the Reason Foundation, which publishes this podcast, I don't even know if that's the right word, it's probably not, rallied opposition to it by using really good, like, data. Like, you can measure some of the stuff. Does it really help outcomes, and was persuasive to people? And I feel like we're in this moment where all this really good research that's been done the last 25, 30 years that tells us about how stuff works, like inflation, people are like, it doesn't matter. Let's just screw it. Let's put it in there. It's popular.
This is also...
Speaking of Meathead and the, you know, that turn in the late 90s to insanity over children who, by every measure, were doing better than ever, that they were actually, you know, had never been at greater risk. It was like, you know, all the kids were hanging out in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome or something like that, at the exact moment where that was absolutely not true. I think it was Brendan O'Neill I saw recently talk about how, you know, public policy right now seems to be captured by the anxieties of upper middle class and upper class people. And that explains a lot of this, where it's, you know, what Biden is doing is he's not playing to a base of actually poor people. He's playing to this kind of fetishized image of what is good and proper and hence should be universal, of upper middle class and upper class Americans who are scared about everything and just want everything to be in some form of government regulated and regimented, you know, holding pattern, especially, you know, K through 12 school, community college, daycare, before and after school, and before and after kindergarten ages. It's very disturbing.
The expanded child tax credit that Biden is pushing as a big part of this package goes to families making up to $400,000 a year.
Yeah. And, you know, this is also another...
It's like, just not enough, Peter. It's
the
not
overlapping,
enough.
The overlapping cutoffs for each of these benefits. Again, we have the child tax credit, we have the child care subsidy, and then we have the universal pre-K. Like, the just for an individual household to figure out what they will or won't be eligible for the first 5 years of their child's life, like, that's already like like a comical amount of kind of paperwork and mental math. It will not be clear to less competent users. And again, like, I just can't figure out additional ways to say, like, we don't have the childcare workers that this bill imagines. Like, they don't exist. People who want, you know, who have the skills that match up with the salaries that will be required are already employed in education or in other fields, and that this bill is not going to magically draw workers into childcare, nor is it going to create these workers who are, you know, who are providing a level of value that's just dictated by the government at 150% of the current salary. And getting the subsidies is going to be harder for smaller providers. You know, this is something that's going to be a burden on everyone, not just the parents, but also on, of course, the child care providers themselves. That means there's going to be more of a gray and black market in child care, which will end up taking the kids who are the least well off, pulling them further out of the existing sort of open market system, and possibly ending up with worse childcare. Like, the quality of the childcare is not going to improve, and the cost is going to skyrocket. And that is not how we should be doing this.
Build back better. Nick, what provision in the bill are you looking at and rubbing your hands together, knowing that you're going to have fodder to make fun of for the next 5 years?
You know, Matt, I don't make fun of any of this stuff. It just, you know, it's tears, really.
Yeah.
More than laughter. I'm like Lance Rentzel. Author of the wonderful NFL biography, disgraced NFL player married to Miss Joey Heatherton, who read a book, When All the Laughter Turned to, what was it? When All the Laughter Turned to Tears.
Yeah.
Or When All the Laughter Turned to Crying. Highly recommended. That's how I feel looking at Joe Biden's budget proposals and what's being voted on or not. You know, it all depends now on whether or not Kristen Sinema can bring her own porta potty wherever she goes, because she's like one more confrontation away, I'm sure, from caving.
Yeah.
But I looked in the infrastructure bill. It was speaking of like upper middle class and upper class fantasies that need to be imposed on the world. In the infrastructure bill, there's $66 billion on rail, kind of rail stuff, most of which is going to go to Amtrak, the nation's intercity passenger rail system. And so that's just a waste, because it, you know, Amtrak is something that people love in the abstract. They love to, you know, imagine the fascinating lives of people that they pass when they're going faster, driving in their car near an Amtrak train. And that's especially true once you get outside of the Acela, you know, corridor, basically from Baltimore to Washington, which has been the only rail line in the Amtrak system. It started in 1971 that ever comes close to at least covering its costs. And it doesn't really do that when you account for capital equipment and all of that kind of stuff, but it's by far the best. And it is pretty highly functioning there. But the worst part of this in the infrastructure bill is that it would also change Amtrak's charter to focus on, quote, intercity passenger rail needs of the U.S. as its mission, as opposed to trying to do a kind of slapdash job and make, you know, make money or break even. So it's just a kind of signal that, don't worry, we've got you. People like Joe Biden, who will never ride Amtrak again, who was Senator Amtrak, who loved riding Amtrak, wouldn't shut the fuck up about riding Amtrak. And then people who take things like the Texas Eagle, or anybody who has taken an Amtrak that is scheduled for more than a 2-hour trip knows that almost always it will end up being 50% longer than its schedule. And that's what we need to subsidize, because, you know, that is, you know, massive rail delays, massive delays on a 19th century technology is infrastructure.
Catherine and Peter, speaking of 19th century infrastructure, how's the subway working in Washington today?
Very badly. It's not even.
You guys want to talk about that?
No. No, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. You know, it appears that a large number of trains are not...
About 60% of the Metro train fleet.
Not compliant with... I mean, it says like manufacturer standards. There's like...
They're doing a recall?
There's some kind of term of art, but it absolutely is just like, oops, we forgot to maintain these trains or check to make sure they're still good. Our bad. We'll get back to you on this.
There and was, in fact, a derailment last week.
Yes, there was.
And there had been problems prior to that. So on the one hand, it's probably true that most of these trains are essentially safe. It's also maybe true that none of them are. And this is the fleet that they built, that they bought 6 years ago and was supposed to last 40 years. And they have now taken it basically entirely offline, at least for today and maybe for a long time.
Starting to sound a lot like Nazi Germany.
Meanwhile,
right? 1,000 years, give or take. 993.
Meanwhile, the New York Times is running articles today that say, like, you know, Uber and Lyft ride-sharing apps failed to deliver on their promise. And it's like,
oh god,
you know who made me some promises? WMATA, like MTA, like they made some promises to us
while taking your money.
While taking my money, Uber, they failed to deliver on a promise to me once. Cool, I will never use them again. I will not be so lucky with subway and rail transit.
Suderman, what did you look in the bill and discover is wonderful?
Yeah, so even aside from the cost issues, we have this healthcare system in the United States, a health policy system that is just an absolute logistical mess. So right now, just to kind of like set the stage for you here, you have private health insurance from insurers, implicitly subsidized through the tax code since about World War II. You have private health insurance subsidized through Obamacare. You have Medicare, which is effectively a single-payer program, but only for seniors, financed fully by the federal government, and which exerts a huge implicit influence on the private healthcare system because of the prices that it pays. And then you also have Medicaid, which is a jointly funded program through states and the federal government. It uses a formula called FMAP, which almost no one really understands, even Medicaid professionals, in part because it varies from state to state, and there's 50 different programs here. So as part of this bill, what Democrats are trying to do is they want to expand Medicare at a cost of probably about $350 billion. They want to expand Obamacare, and then they want to add an entirely new federal program to close what they see as gaps in the Medicaid program. Now, this goes back to the very first Supreme Court challenge to Obamacare. I'm sure you have all of these ordered in your head and can like remember exactly what was going on back in 2012. So
Broccoli.
That was right around when the first Avengers movie was happening, just so that you guys can
God.
Like, yep, sorry, that's how it's going to go. But you need like that time marker, right? And so in the summer of 2012, we got...
Yeah, we need that time marker.
You have to like put yourself back in time. In the summer of 2012, you had the first big Obamacare case, and most people thought up front that it was going to be about the individual mandate. Well, they basically said that the individual mandate was kind of sort of constitutional enough that we're going to allow it to go through. But what they did say, and the big effect of that ruling, was that the Medicaid expansion would be optional for states. So the initial idea was that every state would basically have to expand Medicaid under Obamacare. And what happened as a result of that ruling was that initially only about half of the states expanded Medicaid, and some more have since, but there are still about a dozen states that have not expanded Medicaid under Obamacare. And so Democrats would like that to not be the case, but since they can't force those states to expand Medicaid, their plan here is, well, we've got this mess of a system. I guess it's already so messy, it doesn't matter if we throw some more mess on the mess. And that is part of what they're contemplating. Now, I should say, just as a caveat, that we have no idea if this will actually be in the bill. And it may be that the expanded Medicare benefits will go in and the new Medicaid program will not. This is all up in the air right now, and it could change by next week.
Yeah, the up in the air part is also worth highlighting here. I mean, Bernie Sanders is complaining that the press has done a lousy job of covering the components of the bill. And let's assume for the sake of argument that he is correct. One of the reasons why that might come to pass is that the way that they know what's in it is that Nancy Pelosi has a press conference and they say, hey, is this thing still in it? And she goes, yeah, baby, or no, or yes. Or we're talking to Joe Manchin on Thursday. This is all being negotiated by like seven people. And that's just a really piss poor way to do a single bill about a single one of any of these things, let alone something that's going to be so gigantic. Speaking of gigantic, Nick, I know you've been looking at the corporate tax rate increase aspect of this, which is not small.
I follow it obsessively.
I know.
It's the only thing that keeps me up.
Nick,
getting up in the morning.
19% solution Gillespie here.
Yeah, I think corporations are more human than most of the people we pass on the street, Matt.
As it currently stands, I think they're kicking up the corporate rate back up from 21%, which is the Trump cut, to 26.5%, I believe.
Yes, sir.
And this used to be 35% before the Trump cut, I think. That's not small. And it might have some effects. Nick, do you want to talk about what you've learned?
Yeah, that's the other thing to think about all of this bill, of course, which doesn't cost anything. It's absolutely free, as Joe Biden has said. So I guess this is all a hypothetical discussion. But the Tax Foundation, which is, you know, reliably conservative and market oriented and sneering towards massive expansions of the state, you know, did a study where they found that the Build Back Better bill would shrink the GDP over in its first decade by about 1% over that period of time, reduce wages by 0.68%, and eliminate about the equivalent of 300,000 jobs. One of the things that's fascinating about it is that they also said that for every dollar of new tax revenue, the government or the economy would lose $2. So it's just
reverse multiplier.
And most of that is because of the increase of the corporate tax rate, which the Trump cuts help bring us back into something like competition with the rest of the developed world. This would kick us back up. But again, it's this, and I know Peter has talked a lot about this over the past year or so. Biden and like the thinking in the Democratic Party in particular now is that they want a government that is somehow able to see every interaction, every transaction, everything that is going on in the economy, and beyond the economy, but specifically in the economy. And that kind of surveillance takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of oomph out of the economy. And that's one of the things that should be discussed as much as all the dumb stuff that is in this type of legislation. It should also be, what are the costs, both in terms of numbers and what they say it's going to cost, but then in the effects on the economy, as well as kind of the psyche of American business and customers.
Catherine, we've seen a spate of articles in the New York Times, speaking of upper middle class anxieties, just upper class anxieties. The New York Times, Huffington Post, elsewhere, that basically spell out or elaborate on a quote that I think was in the Times piece from the Deputy Director of the White House National Economic Council, David Kamen, who says, "We can't afford not to do these kinds of investments." What do you say to that general critique, Catherine?
I have decided that there's a new rule, which is that when anyone calls anything an investment that is not actually a thing regulated by the SEC, that they are full of it. That they are just because this works for everything, right? It works both for federal spending, which is usually not an investment. It's usually spending. Sometimes it's spending that has long-term benefits, and sometimes it's not. Often it's not. But this also is true when it's like, I'm going to invest in these jeans. You know what I mean? Like, people say that, like, I'm going to invest in self-care. No, you're not. You're going to spend money. You're spending money to consume something. And sometimes that's okay, but it's not an investment.
I have invested in a lot of unique bottles of whiskey.
Yes, I'm investing in this vinyl, like, collector's garbage. Like, no.
You don't even know what the words are for vinyl.
I tried. I started
collector's
to say
garbage?
A sentence. Did you hear me be like, ruh-roh, I can't finish this sentence because I care about this shit so little. Like, just in general, I'm like, this is my new rule. I think when you apply it, you will find that it works like 98% of the time. And it especially works on this spending. We can't afford not to give $450 billion to a childcare subsidy. Yes, we can. We absolutely can afford not to do that. And we certainly should choose not to do that. That is not a good use of that money. I think this battle, too, of everything is the most important thing, right? Like, that's where we are in this bill right now, because we don't know what's in it, because of the Nancy Pelosi press conference phenomenon, because of the waiting for Manchin to tell us what's real phenomenon. It means that you get, you know, the climate activists are going nuclear, but not in a good way. You get that the, You get that the immigration activists are storming out of Zoom meetings, furious, again, with the like 5 to 7 real decision makers in the process. And, you know, they have no reason not to completely lose their minds. They have no reason not to go all in, because once whatever version of this thing gets passed actually happens, that's it. That's the, like, everyone will be exhausted. Every single person in Washington will have to go somewhere and lie down with a cold cloth over their eyes for like 3 years before we can do anything else.
Oh, I was just going to say they're going to have be dreaming of how to spend all of that money. You know, that gets passed. We have in 2019, we spent $4.4 trillion. In 2020, $6.6 trillion. In 2021, $6.8 trillion. And, you know, there's no reason to, you know, to reel it in anytime soon.
Except we didn't even spend that money, right? Like, that's the other thing that's amazing, is we appropriated that money, but we can't even shovel the dollars out the door. We can't even... like, we're not even able to spend that money.
I mean, this goes back to your point about the lack of availability of pre-K childcare workers, right? And this is an issue if they build an entirely new Medicaid program, too, in a somewhat different way. You know, there's a great bit in an AP story about this, where, you know, one of the ways that they're looking to reduce the cost on the Medicaid program is to set it up so that technically it expires after some number of years, right? So if you run the program in legislation for a full decade, then the score for that legislation will assume that it has a cost every year. But if you say, oh, you know what, we're only going to run this program through 2027, then the score for the program will assume that it doesn't cost anything after 2027, even though, of course, the idea is that once you get there, whoever is in Congress at the time will reauthorize that spending. But the part of the goal here, part of what they're talking about is you have advocates for this program who are saying, well, look, you know, if they have to cut back the number of years that they're going to run this thing, I hope that they at least provide enough spending for enough years that they get this program actually up and running, because it's going to be really hard. And there's just this great little kind of a sideline in an AP story about this, where it says Medicaid is one of the most complex government programs, and splicing in a new federal component for a limited number of states could be a time-consuming process. Yes.
Could be.
Yes, it is going to be. All of this is going to be time consuming. All of this is going to be logistically complicated, in addition to costing a huge, huge amount of money. And the results of those logistical complications are going to be a lot of programs that don't work maybe at all, or at least not nearly as well as they are promised. Say, for example, like the Washington Metro.
Nick, I am just thinking out loud here, which is probably a problem. But I recall in the fall of 2008, we would hear from the likes of then Washington establishment types during the financial crisis. They would always talk about the cost of doing nothing right now,
yep.
Right? David Brooks, after the Republicans in the House briefly did not vote for the first bailout. There was Free market nihilism was on the rampage. And you had all these Michael Bloomberg and John McCain types saying, like, it doesn't matter what we do, we have to do something. And it's there's been this incredible, I don't know if the slippery slope is the right way to put it, but control V-ing of the same notion to describe something that's not a crisis, right? Like, we're now talking about the cost of doing nothing when, I mean, there is a crisis. It's coronavirus, and this stuff doesn't really do much of anything to help with that, as far right. as I can tell. But everything is a crisis, and the cost of doing nothing to everything right now is going to be apocalyptic. It makes your eyes kind of glaze.
Matt, I wasn't even paying attention to you because
I know.
You were reminding me of things that politicians said in the past. You know, it's also, though, the good news here is that, you know, this is, they are stuffing the turkey, man, and they've been doing it for the past couple of years. Coronavirus, you know, allowed for that to happen, hence, you know, the $6 trillion budgets. But I think everybody recognizes that's coming to an end. That's why the Democrats could pass all of this legislation if they could get all the Democrats to do it. They have a majority, they have the votes, or they have the numbers, but they don't have the votes. because people are saying enough. I was buoyed over the weekend by a new Gallup poll, which found that 52% of Americans said government was doing too many things. A year ago, 54% favored government doing more to solve everybody's goddamn problems. Already, that has flipped back to the historical reality where a majority, and oftentimes it can be as high as 60 or 60 something percent, say government is doing too many things that businesses and individuals should be doing. I think we are, this is why it is a crisis for the people who want to spend ungodly amounts of tax dollars, because they recognize this Overton window is getting bricked over. And so they're scrambling to get everything in there before, things shut down.
As a final-ish word on the topic of what are they building in there in these bills, two bits I would point to. One, we've mentioned before, is that there is a provision to vastly boost the IRS's ability to snoop on financial records. Currently, although there's negotiations in the dark rooms about this, currently the idea is that if any bank account has $600 worth of transactions in a year, that account must be have its annual inflows and outflows, at least a total of that number, reported to the IRS, which is just a drastic expansion of their ability to look at things. And that would disproportionately affect not the wealthy and the big fat corporations, but people who are doing $600 worth of transactions. It might affect my daughter, although I think I'm cutting her off after this morning. So that's one provision. And the other one that should excite all people is that there's a proposal to throw $1 billion worth of mostly tax subsidies for journalism jobs. So if you're thinking in your heart, like, gosh, you know what I'd really like to have my tax money go to, or to make sure that it goes from other people, it's to support journalism jobs at existing journalism institutions and not new ones. That's in there. And so far, it's mostly been ignored. And to the extent that it has been paid attention to by the journalism, the free press industry, it's like a seal-like applause for having the government decide who is a journalist and who it can subsidize. It's awful. Enough about that. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, are you being held back by depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, and such like? You can do something about that today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable to receive instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. BetterHelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what the Dodgers need in the ninth inning, has helped more than 1 million people take control of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month, with other financial aid also available, even though BetterHelp.com is affordable to begin with. Go to the website, BetterHelp.com/roundtable, describe your issues and your preferred technological methods of delivery, and they'll get you someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't like that person, you can swap him or her out. Please visit BetterHelp.com today. You'll be glad you did. All right, keep sending your great emails to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Tyler Anderson from Sacramento, California. Cowtown. Love it. Tyler says, I am a Jones Act mariner. While I and many other American merchant mariners are pretty libertarian, the Jones Act is the third rail of the maritime industry and turns many mariners away from the libertarian movement. Cato, Ronald Reagan, and John McCain are not popular among Jones Act mariners. While I agree with many reforms, like removing the U.S. shipbuilding requirement for Jones Act, that is domestic trade, I do not agree with removing the cabotage rules for domestic trade. Airlines, trucking, and trains all enjoy cabotage protections for domestic trade, but it always seems that the sights are always on the Jones Act unfairly and the American merchant marine. I've consistently made the argument that there are other heavy industries in these U.S. that compete with foreign actors regularly. Hell, I drive a Toyota, fly on Airbus planes, and probably ride Siemens trains. And that same attitude should be introduced to the American shipbuilding market. For clarification, for the cruise ship enjoying public, the Passenger Vessel Services Act, which frustrates a good many of the American cruising public, like Nick Gillespie, is separate from the Jones Act, but has the same flavor. What say you, Roundtable? Catherine, it's a bit of homework here. I made you look up cabotage. What do you say to our SACTO friend.
I 100% did look up cabotage today because I am excited about that word. I think also, can we pronounce it with a little more? Can we be like cabotage? Like I want it cabotage. To be more sabotage-y.
Ouf, fromage.
I
want to go to a good French restaurant and order some of that.
Some of the cabotage with a little bit of baguette. Yeah. So I think that our letter writer makes a good point, which is that libertarians do tend to be a little bit over-focused on the Jones Act. You know, he's quite right that we have all kinds of protectionist policies, and this is just one of them. I think that one reason for that has, in recent years, has been Puerto Rico. Because we have this sort of very specific object lesson in the ways that Jones Act has been screwing people over, and because we stared at a world where the Jones Act was briefly waived in an effort to help them, that makes it feel like there are more moving parts there, sort of to eliminate other protectionist policies that are sort of morally similar can just feel more challenging. And the Jones Act is always quite just on the, you know, there's always some guy in Congress, it's like Mike Lee or somebody, who's always about to get rid of the thing. You know, with all due respect to our letter writer, I think a lot of people like the exception for their industry and don't think the exceptions should exist for other industries. I suspect Jones Act mariners are no exception. They are used to the way it is, and they also probably are speaking from a sense of fair play. This is the thing that ends up being a huge part of the argument for any kind of protectionist policy is, well, the other guys are doing it. The other guys are cheating, have given themselves advantage, have given themselves protection, or their governments are subsidizing them. So we have to do the same in order to level the playing field. As always, my answer is that other people's bad behavior is no excuse for our own. And that's true for public policy and for parenting.
Suderman, did you do your cabotage homework?
Yeah, but I mean, I will just sort of talk about the Jones Act more specific, you know, more generally, because I actually think it's worth zeroing in on the big, big problem with the Jones Act, which is that it makes goods cost more. And it means there's no international competition moving stuff between U.S. ports, and it means there's no domestic carriers have to spend more on ships, and that drives up shipping costs, and then those costs are passed on to the rest of us. And so what does that do? It makes things more expensive than they otherwise would be, more expensive than they need to be. And that's not just a minor trivial thing, even though in some cases it's just 50 cents or a dollar on a can of something at the store or a toy that you're buying for, you know, your nephew for Christmas. That is a cost in life and time. And that's a big problem. And so this is why one of my strongest beliefs is that lower prices are a moral good. Because lower prices are in some ways the closest thing we will ever get to getting more time in this world. So I can't give you an extra hour in this day, but what if I could say that your work, the income that you are already earning, went further and bought more? That is the closest thing I can do to giving you more time. It makes your time more valuable. It means that you're getting more out of the time that you already have, and that's what lower prices represent. And so the Jones Act is an impediment to that, and that's why I think it's a big problem, and we should not be afraid to say that lower prices are not just something that is more convenient. They're not just something that people like. They are a great moral good because they give more wealth, more life to people, all over at least the United States, which is, you know, where the Jones Act covers.
Nick, do you want to insert a Seattle Mariners joke here?
No, I don't. That's just not funny,
okay.
Matt.
Just giving you opportunities. Okay, let's. Apparently, Nick woke up on the not funny
Nick's
part
not
of
Nick's not laughing
the bed
today. Serious business out
this,
here
this morning.
Not at the Seattle
the
Mariners.
The Jones Act that's, isn't funny.
I mean, that's like laughing at the handicap.
Always pulling one out. Let's go to I wanted to make sure that we had enough time to talk at least a little bit about a 90-year-old who went into space last week. His name is William Shatner. Catherine, I know that you would have fired me again if I didn't give enough space for this. Do you want to wax poetical about our greatest living Canadian and his trip up into space?
William Shatner went to space. Like, he pretended to be in space for so long, and then he got to really go. He's so old. He's so old. I got a chance to see him slash meet him at Freedom Fest a few years back, I think.
Oh, that's right.
And, you know, this guy's just out here, like, working conventions for cash. He's got hustle, and nobody deserves it more than William Shatner. You know, I think this is again, just like a beautiful, beautiful illustration of the kind of weird, great stuff that happens when space is in the hands of private industry. You know, NASA was not going to send William Shatner to space. At most, they were going to bring him out to do a little speech before a launch at some point, maybe. But even then, like, who knows, the government contracting process and probably, you know, some PR people would find a bad tweet or just note that he had been at Freedom Fest and then that would be out. But you get cool, weird stuff when billionaires are allowed to keep all their money and do what they want with it. And William Shatner going to space, which should bring joy to us all, except for the sourest of pusses among us, is a great example of that.
Such as Star Trek's own Sulu.
George Takei
was very upset, incredibly angry.
That's some sour grapes right there. You think he's just mad he wasn't invited?
One of the really powerful things is when Shatner came back and was bubbling over with what he had seen, and the look on his face and the discussion was pretty transcendent. And I think just to second what Catherine was saying, it's phenomenal. It reeks a little bit of a lesser Philip K. Dick novel, where a guy who plays a space traveler ends up becoming a space traveler. And I suspect, you know, when the cosmic rays or whatever, battered Shatner up there in orbit start to fulminate, and he becomes a werewolf or a giant or something like that, that will make this even more
interesting. I also want to say, like, he quoted Isaac Newton, right? Like, he like, it was this beautiful quote and he delivered it beautifully. And the number
almost
of people,
like an actor,
the number of people that thought that those were William Shatner's spontaneous thoughts, like, it was too many people, y'all. Like, he seems lovely, but he's an actor. He's not a deep thinker, and that's okay. Isaac
Good.
Newton.
Delivering.
No.
The
Unlike
word.
Stop.
That's just awful. Awful.
Let's not forget that he's also a very talented singer.
Yeah.
Who I saw perform live with the Ben Folds 5 backing band. Ooh. and Joe Jackson at the El Rey Theater in Los Angeles, California. It's a phenomenal concert.
Tell me you're Gen X without telling me you're Gen X.
It's pretty Gen X-y. It strikes me that him and I forget one of the other, I think it was one of the billionaires when they came down from space. There have been a couple of moments like that where the privates have gone up there and they came down and they were kind of overwhelmed with emotion. And it strikes me that like, we haven't really had that sense for a while because the people have been going up to space are pros and they're not going to lose it. You know, like when, Rocket Man, which, we're all kind of referring to because Shatner delivered the classic performance of that. Although Chris Elliott, as Nick points out, does the classic Shatner performance of that. But like there was that period in pop music where people, and it wasn't just pop music, it was literature and elsewhere, where people were like really like reflecting on the meaning of it all, of space. And like people have kind of stopped. And now with the reintroduction of or the introduction of private people up there, we're getting that sense again, which is kind of nice. Sense of wonder, right?
Wonder.
Suderman, which Marvel cinematic person should go into space according to your algorithm?
I mean, they should probably send Bradley Cooper in Rocket Raccoon form.
I would love to see Samuel L. Jackson uncensored.
Oh my God!
Describing the beauty and terror of space.
No, put him and Werner Herzog
and David Attenborough. That's my trio.
It is dead. There is no oxygen. You could not
Werner
breathe.
Herzog,
it will kill you.
David Attenborough, Samuel L. Jackson. On a flight to space.
And,
open
and maybe Matt Welch.
Yeah.
One-way ticket.
Please, one-way ticket. All right, speaking of one-way tickets, let's go to our end of podcast. what we have all been consuming. Peter, do you want to lead us off?
Yeah, so I saw the new Halloween movie, unlike a lot of people. I saw it at home, which I'm really surprised. People turned out for this one. Huge, huge weekend box office, despite tepid reviews, and long delay. A little bit unexpected here. But here is my two-word review of the movie, which is titled Halloween Kills. It doesn't. No, it's really not very good. And I actually liked the last one. But I am still happy that I saw it. And I will tell you why. And what this movie sort of reinforced to me is that I missed watching bad movies that other people were interested in and sort of seeing movies come out that didn't work. And so, you know, basically all of my life since I was 9 or 10, I've been going to the movies about every week. Obviously, that changed last year for the first time. And it just made me feel kind of like off and unsettled throughout the entire year, not having this steady stream of new films to process. And part of being a film fan is not just loving great movies and enjoying seeing the pretty good ones as they come out, but also watching the failures and the mistakes and having some sort of appreciation for how hard it is to make a big budget or even a small budget feature film and understanding what the baseline is so that when you see the good thing, and there have been a bunch of good things that have come out recently and a couple more that are going to come out this weekend, Dune is coming out and I'm going to talk about that soon. And it's just like it's actually important to me to see the bad movies like Halloween Kills, even though they aren't very good. And I'm very glad that I now live in a world where I don't have to make the trek to the theater. I can see this on Peacock, a streamer that you guys haven't even heard of, but like comes for free with my cable package. And I can sit at home and watch it in my basement and know that it's bad that way.
This that reminds me of the plot of Brainstorm in some way, which is not doesn't speak well of the
that ends well.
God, I won't.
You know when Dune comes out, and you know how we were talking about Shatner, yes. William Shatner
of our time.
Being transcendent. Dune is going to be like the inverse of that. That's my guess.
Okay, what if you saw an actual good movie, Nick? Right.
I did. I watched the Velvet Underground documentary in a movie theater. It's also on Apple TV by Todd Haynes, who has done a series of great music-related movies during the course of his career. Did Velvet Goldmine, which is a really kind of great look at glam rock and elements of punk and whatnot. He did I'm Not There, a fantastic series of vignettes that kind of tell a story about Bob Dylan, just fantastic. And then the Velvet Underground, which is about the band of that name. It's made up of contemporaneous footage, mostly. There's a ton of stuff that involves things like Andy Warhol and Warhol's Factory, as well as live interviews with the two surviving, three surviving members, Doug Yule, who is not quite a full member of the band, but John Cale and Maureen Tucker, who Maureen Tucker is the greatest in this because she is just like an old dame from Georgia. She was outed during the Tea Party era as a Tea Party fanatic when she was interviewed by an unwitting journalist at a protest like outside of Walmart in Georgia at some point. But it's fantastic because what it does is if you love the band, this is like the greatest thing in the world to see. It's the closest to seeing them in the Exploding Plastic Inevitable in the 60s or a live show. It's really artistically interesting, and it gets at this sense of multi-sensorial overload in the Velvet Underground's music, but more importantly, the scene that kind of produced them and that they helped sustain in New York in the 60s and into the very early 70s. A eulogy for them in that moment, but also really just kind of like inspiring. And you want to go out and create art and consume art in all kinds of, you know, whether it's music, you know, literature, theater, you know, painting, you name it, video. It's so Velvet Underground, a fantastic work of art about a band that is just endlessly influential.
Nick and I wrote in Declaration of Independence how the Velvet Underground weirdly influenced and sort of co-named the Velvet Revolution in Prague, which is a kind of a fascinating story about how culture no one was consuming in America at the time, outside a small number of people, smuggled its way out and influenced people. And as part of the release of this documentary, I went and tried to look on YouTube to see whether there are many good clips of a band that I saw played 25 times called the Velvet Underground Revival, which is this band that started in the 80s when you could not play those songs. You could not play. You had to get everything officially sanctioned by the government. So the only loophole in that was weddings. If you had a wedding, it was considered so private that you could play. So you had all these like crazy avant-garde acts, the Plastic People, the Universe, et al., some of whom played in the Velvet Underground Revival band, would just go play weddings. And so as part of that, I found, and I tweeted out, and you can find it pretty easily too, on YouTube, their first concert. Someone videotaped it in like May 1987 of these Czech guys playing it, and it's marvelous. So I recommend looking at that.
Catherine, you would say we should check it out.
Wow,
Catherine, you have the blade under the table there and can wield it as necessary. What did you consider?
I don't want to record the screaming, so I'll wait till after we're done with the podcast. I listened to a new podcast. It's called Once Upon a Time at Bennington College, and it is it actually came to my attention because Donna Tartt, the novelist, author of A Secret History, The Secret History. A Secret History. There are secrets in the history.
The Secret History.
It's The Secret History, the only one. And she sent a lawyery type letter to this podcast, which of course immediately piqued my interest because what is in there that she doesn't want people to know? It is a podcast about the Bennington class of 1986, which contained Bret Easton Ellis, Donna Tartt, and Jonathan Latham. So quite a crew. And apparently the events depicted in The Secret History, which is, despite the fact that I couldn't remember the name of it, one of my favorite books and a book that was incredibly important to me in college when I thought I was also maybe sort of living the life of this book. Seems like it was a little bit truer to life than I might have guessed. So Bennington College was this kind of weird place in Vermont. No grades, no rules, extremely expensive. And it was 1986. So just like the result here is like cocaine, weird sex, and like really, really, really huge amounts of literary talent. And they all like hated each other and like loved each other and tried to murder each other. And in the wish fulfillment that is The Secret History, maybe that got a little out of hand. There's like some incredible kind of Apollonian versus Dionysian like nonsense in there. And most of the sort of center of gravity of this story centers, it anchors on a elite seminar on the ancient Greeks. So just like if any of those words sounded good to you, and yep. I recognize that a significant proportion of our listenership will be like, no, none of those words sounded good to me. And that's fine.
That one.
But if those words sound good to you, this podcast is really, really interesting. The narrator of this podcast, who I think is also basically the writer and producer, she has a particular taste, y'all. Like she has a very, very theater kid presentation. And it was tough. It was tough for me at first, but I stuck it out. And she won me over toward the end of the first episode, I think, when she basically says, like, listen, when I tell people that I'm working on a podcast that centers on the story of Bret Easton Ellis, people say words like, and then she says this like incredible list of like MAGA asshat douchebag monster person. And she's like, and I agree with you, or I did agree with you until I actually consumed his work and I realized he was one of the greatest thinkers and potentially artists of our time. And here's my story of how I turned around on Bret Easton Ellis. I also feel that way about Bret Easton Ellis. I don't like liking him, but I sometimes do like him and I struggle with that. My feelings about Donna Tartt are much less complicated. My feelings about Jonathan Latham are kind of like, don't need it. But it's the podcast is very, very self-aware and self-conscious. It's very theater kiddy, but man, did she get access, and man, is it a juicy story.
If I may self-promote a bit, we did an interview with Bret Easton Ellis a couple of years ago before his His essay collection White came out, which is why he's been called a MAGA ass hat douchebag, all of that kind of stuff, which is a real misreading of him. But that interview and that book White by him is quite interesting about cultural production in a globalized economy of self-hating liberals and progressives in Hollywood who have no understanding of the audiences that they're seeking to entertain.
And she actually specifically notes, the narrator of this podcast specifically notes the essay that turned her around on him, which is his essay about the meaning of Charlie Sheen. So if you are interested in having your mind changed about Bryce Dallas Ellis
or Charlie Sheen.
Or Charlie, well, of course, the essay's not really about Charlie Sheen, is it? It's really about
it's about
the
John Cryer,
shift from media to social media and user generated culture.
Does it start with an extended passage on Hotshots Part 2?
It's probably set at a conference. I don't know, but
fantastic movie.
Yeah. So if you like me, enjoy having your mind changed, especially about late 20th century voicey man writers, because I am really always trying to give those dudes a shot. Maybe start there.
It's a great Gen X kind of document, Matt. You might enjoy it for that reason.
My cultural consumption is aspirational. Haven't consumed it yet, but enough people came out of the woodwork and
wait. Can we have a vote quickly and call bullshit on this? So your consumption is something that you have not consumed.
This is allowed. Do you think I finished listening to this podcast?
No. After this, it is just jungle law.
You're not the boss of us, Nick.
Mere anarchy is loose.
You're not the boss. And this has happened in the past with panelists not named me. So mine is aspirational. I was suggested. She's just, I think if you look at the flowchart, matters. So out of the woodwork, a friend of reason, Tim DeRoche, great writer about education in Southern California, said, "Hey, Matt, you should see this documentary. It's called The Battered Bastards of Baseball, a 2014 documentary that came out. It covers an independent minor league baseball team called the Portland Mavericks, Portland, Oregon, that went for about 5 years in the 70s, owned by Bing Russell, who's the father of Kurt Russell, who played on the team and is narrating the story in there. And when I expressed on Twitter, no, I hadn't even heard of this, hadn't seen it. And a bunch of people, including Reason staffers, like, oh, my God, you have to see it. It's totally great. People were saying this in relation to a Reason feature I did about minor league baseball. Some of those issues come up because it's an independent team trying to be in a world where Major League Baseball runs roughshod over the minor league system. It has rave reviews everywhere, and it's available on Netflix. It's from 2014, Battered Bastards Baseball. And if it's bad, you can blame Nick, mostly. What I actually did...
I take full responsibility for it.
What I actually did...
For Matt not watching and yet recommending a documentary.
Consume was an old email that I received from someone whose death was announced today, Colin Powell.
Were you in a coma last week or something?
He's trying to do an obit. Give the man some space.
It's too late to teach manners to a 75-year-old man. Colin Powell died at age 84, and I was trying to remember, why does he sound familiar? I had gone on MSNBC in 2013 and apparently used the phrase Pottery Barn rule, and he was pissed. So he wrote me an email, found my email address somewhere, and wrote the following. "Dear Mr. Welch, I was channel surfing this morning." Yeah, right, Colin. We know what you gab on. "And caught your interview on Jansing, Chris Jansing, saying that my 'if you break it, you own it' statement was a strategy proposal for Afghanistan in December 2001. Just for the record, I said that in 2002 relative to a possible Iraq invasion, and it was not a proposed strategy. It was a warning and a caution that once we take out a government, we have governmental responsibilities until we turn it back over." And that was the email. For which I thanked him and corrected the record promptly. And I just want to point out that in a lot of the discussion about him dying because he was fully vaccinated, reportedly, Some people irresponsibly, John Roberts of Fox is one of them. It's like, oh, this shows vaccines don't work. I was 84 and had multiple myeloma. I don't even know what that is, but that sounds serious, which means that he was more susceptible to all kinds of things happening to him. So that's it. That's all the obituaries and Nick scoffing that we have time for. Please listen to Nick scoff on his own dime on the Reason interview. Comes out on Wednesdays. And Gene Epstein Soho Forum debate series is also terrific. Find it all at reason.com/podcasts. Goodbye.